Bé, bon, reprenem el simpòsium. Bé, per mi és un altre gran plaer de poder-nos presentar a David Lomas. For me it's a pleasure to introduce David Lomas. He's an associate director of the ARC Research Center for Studies of Surrealism and its Legacies of the Manchester University. He co-edits the center's online journal, Papers of Surrealism, and has organized a number of conferences and other events under the auspices of the center, including a conference on the theme of experimentalism in science and avant-garde culture. He's co-curating a forthcoming major loan exhibition, whose name is Subversive Space, at the Withward Art Gallery that will explore legacies of surrealism within contemporary art. In 2008, Lomas was awarded an ARC funding for a 3-year project on surrealism and sexuality. Thank you very much. He will talk about on anachronism, Dalí, and the end of painting. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. I suspect my university website must be well out of date, because the Subversive Spaces exhibition took place in 2009. So. You know, it's there's something intrinsically pleasurable about talking about Dalí. So I'm, you know, while I'm somewhat daunted to be speaking in the company of people much more expert on the subject than myself, I'm, you know, very grateful for this invitation. Actually, I'd been thinking quite recently about Dalí's metamorphosis of Narcissus in relation to spectroscopic photographs. So perhaps if I, you know, allow my two eyes to diverge, I can fuse the two audiences into one. How to become anachronistic. We need to acknowledge Dalí's prescience in posing this question in an article published in 1934. Far more prominence has been accorded to Walter Benjamin's celebrated claim that surrealism discovered the radicality of, quote, the outmoded. The concept of the outmoded as a site of artistic intervention chimes with the very topical concern in theory and art practice with accelerating obsolescence as a consequence of technological change. Witness, for example, Tacita Dean's monument to analog film, a now obsolete medium installed earlier this year in Tate Modern's Turbine Hall. My concern in this lecture is with what is termed the end of painting. Painting, Dalí's chosen medium, was itself anachronistic, and Dalí was cognizant of that fact. His misfortune as a painter, though in this respect he was not alone amongst great 20th century artists, one thinks, for instance, of the current retrospective of Gerhard Richter, was to have come after the end of painting. I'm cheating a little bit, since although I shall be talking about Dalí as a writer, the theme of this conference, it is his writings about painting that are my principal concern. The first section of my paper I've called From Anti-Painting to the Restoration of Painting. Dalí invokes the idea of a radical form of anachronism in connection with Art Nouveau, which he counterposes to Corbusian-style architecture, a subject already admirably treated by Félix Farnèse. Here, I shall focus rather on Dalí's attitude to the, quote, ultra-retrograde academicism of Meissonier, an acknowledged source for his miniaturist technique. Louis Aragon's essay, The Challenge to Painting, published as the catalogue preface to an exhibition of collage, evinces a renewed and virulent Dada anti-art impulse that surfaces around 1930, to which Dalí cannot have been impervious. Aragon states that contemporary collage is, and I quote, in absolute opposition to painting and beyond painting. Aragon draws attention to Dalí's seemingly perverse use of the collage medium in such a way as to confound the mechanically reproduced image with hand-painted sections. He also highlights the literary aspect of Dalí's painting, which in its profusion of descriptive detail he compares to a novel. In this way, he asserts, Dalí associates himself with that anti-pictorial spirit which recently caused the painters, then the critics, to scream, and which today is invading painting. In a Barcelona context, Dalí would have been aware of Juan Miró's famous and no less paradoxical claim to assassinate painting. Dalí is not out of step with this thinking that identifies certain painting as anti-pictorial, and it is precisely in these terms that he seeks to valorize the anachronistic sort of academicism of Meissonier. For Breton, however, Dalí's strident advocacy of a reactionary style of painting and his denunciation of modern art is a cause for alarm and an increasing source of embarrassment. Breton viewed these enthusiasms of a piece with the inordinate and equally unacceptable interest in the Hitlerian phenomenon, Dalí's term, as a letter of the 23rd of January 1934, levelling a string of accusations against Dalí, makes abundantly clear. And I have an excerpt from this letter, which is kept at the Scottish National Gallery of Modern Art in Edinburgh, on the screen here. My English translation of Gala's corrected copy of Dalí's somewhat elusive original. My concern, this is Breton, is even greater to hear you soon after advocating with a new violence, excluding any possibility of irony, academic painting, and applying yourself to the denigration of modern art, a cause, at least if we consider it in its essence, to which we are all, except you, deeply attached. It is not at a moment when this art is exposed to every kind of persecution in the USSR and Germany that we can tolerate in surrealism your appalling slogan, Retour a Meissonier. I believe that we must oppose with all our means this slogan, which is objectively totally consistent with the belated recognition by you. You had informed us several times recently of the profound reality of the family, of the need for paternal authority, etc., which permits you to put your trust and hope in Hitler. There is a clear coherence, correspondence between these two points, a unity of attitude. This attitude is reactionary. The photograph on the right is a photograph of the group taken by a Russian photographer at roughly this time. It shows sort of Breton and Dalí on the left, and Crevel in the middle, and Éluard on the right-hand side. Crevel, a very loyal supporter of Dalí's within the group, and I think the sort of contrast in body language between Dalí and Breton is particularly instructive with regard to the tensions in their relationship at this moment. Dalí's response to this and the other accusations against him is characteristically robust. He begins by saying that when he speaks out against modern painting, he is not referring to his fellow surrealist painters, but has in mind rather, quote, painters who defend miserable survivals of intellectualist aesthetics. He singles out Matisse, the intellectual masochism of aux enfants purism, the, quote, naturalist dramatism of Lamenck, Segonzac, Kisling, and Derain, abstractionists, quote, Mondrian's more or less repressed and ashamed, as well as the pseudo-surrealism of Cocteau, the present-day futurists, etc., etc., etc. In a conciliatory gesture towards Breton, possibly, Dalí makes an exception for the cubism of Picasso and Braque. The defense of his own technique reiterates at somewhat greater length the terms of an open letter to Breton from the previous year. Oh, thank you very much. And I quote here, I dare say and I firmly believe that an academic technique is the most efficacious, least artistic method for the copy and reproduction of certain irrational visions and images, a technique so discredited and indefensible from the intellectual aesthetic point of view, only warrants consideration by the surrealists in order to make use of it, to objectivize with the maximum of trompe l'oeil, with the most illusionist fetishism, the contents of a delirious new world to which we have just gained access and that remains incommunicable for the moment by any other means of expression. The antipathy towards abstraction remains a constant. In The Conquest of the Irrational of 1936, he denounces the, quote, sticky and retarded Kantians of scatological section d'or. In a comparative table that was included in 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship, Mondrian scores 0 on 6 of the headings. It is notable that he doesn't rate Meissonier very highly either. Maybe, though, Breton's suspicions were right. Abandoning the revolutionary aspirations of the historical avant-garde, he declares surrealism finished and suspicious of abstraction. The Secret Life of Salvador Dalí in 1942 announces a surprising new tack. Instead, and I quote, instead of reaction or revolution, renaissance. Anachronism that to begin with has allied with anti-painting evolves into a quixotic crusade to restore a traditional painterly craft that culminated with the publication of 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship, Dalí's 1948 self-styled treatise on painting. I have a copy here, not stolen from the Foundation's library, it's my own. Actually, I'll just take this opportunity to pour out some warm water. A hilarious drawing in the first few pages of 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship portrays Dalí naked astride the mighty battle horse of craftsmanship about to make his triumphal return to post-war Europe. The image is a flamboyant pastiche of studies for an equestrian monument by Leonardo da Vinci, a gigantic statue he never executed that was to have been 3 times life size and cast in 60 tons of bronze. For reasons that we shall see, Leonardo himself must have seemed to Dalí a no less sturdy bulwark in the task of rescuing painting from the abyss of modern art. A one-page dedication repeats, in fact, and you know this book is in fact a very complex textual construction. And while I sort of intended to focus my lecture today sort of more exclusively around it, I basically ran out of time. But so this is, in a sense, a ongoing project. You know, despite its importance, and really it is the most significant text that Dali wrote about his painting, it's attracted sort of rather little critical commentary to date. I think it's fair to say that it's mostly conservators who have looked most closely at it, and you know, found it to be a very accurate and reliable guide to Dali's painting technique, to his use of colors and so forth. A one-page dedication repeats, in fact, amends the opening lines of The Secret Life. At the age of six, I wanted to be Napoleon, who we saw a moment ago on horseback, and updates its ambition. And I quote, "Now at 45, I want to paint a masterpiece and to save modern art from chaos and laziness. I will succeed. This book is consecrated to this crusade, and I dedicate it to all the young who have faith in true painting." Next is a prologue containing an endorsement by Francesc Pujols, who notes that Salvador Dali was aptly named in order to be this savior of painting. Dali, of course, returns the compliment in the form of an unconventional monument at the top of this the street next to us. A forerunner of the controversial polemic Cocus du Vieil Art Moderne of 1956, The 50 Secrets of Modern Craftsmanship follows a similar pattern to Giorgio de Chirico's short treatise on painting technique of 1928, which Dali may have known. On the one hand, deploring our miserable era of mechanical and technological progress, and blaming the decadence of painting on a decline of technique, and on the other, offering a surfeit of technical recipes. Quote, "A kind of culinary initiation to the Eleusinian mysteries of painting, intended to make good that lack." Dali keeps up the attack in a chapter of the main text, which covers the nitty-gritty of pigments and their use, contrasting the old masters with risible modern painters in whose works, quote, "the colors pulverize, immediately disintegrated by the solvents of druggists, the poison of laziness, the detritus of impatience, and the bile of rancor." He berates the Impressionist artists for the monstrous sin of abolishing black from their palette, claiming to have observed on a visit to a noted collection of modern art the wretched consequences, and I quote, "the violaceous, blued, congested, herpetic aspect of all those colorations, especially the flesh tones, each of which evokes, before anything else, the most disagreeable varieties of skin disease." Actually, thinking back to what Astrid was saying earlier, I suspect there's a an allusion to Wiesmann there, to the description of flowers in very similar terms in Against Nature. It is Galla who is credited with inspiring the renaissance of classicism in Dali. Comparing her to a bee, he says it was she who found and brought back to his studio, his precious pigments and media, about which he discourses at excessive length in 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship. And it appears she also obtained for him various treatises of Renaissance painting. Amongst Dali's extensive and well-thumbed collection of books on Leonardo is a copy of the Peladon French translation of Leonardo's treatise on painting. A sinuous blue pencil line running down the left margin, scarcely omitting a passage in many sections of the book, tracks Dali's attentive reading of this critically important textual source and testifies to an unsuspected interlacing of two artistic personalities. Dali listens in as Leonardo advises on the nobility of painting and the necessary universality of the painter. When it reaches the famous passage about seeking inspiration from stains on walls, his pencil reacts like a seismograph, excitedly screeching up and down before moving on. Once ingested and absorbed, the Traité de la Peinture reemerges as inimitably Dali in 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship. Dali glosses Leonardo's advice to view one's picture through a mirror in order to more easily detect any infelicities in proportion with his own more long-winded version. Written in the manner of a handbook for painters, the book is a counterpart to the Leder Atomica, a manifesto of his new style, which is illustrated within its pages along with two studies. And that's one of the studies that Dali reproduces there, that you see there. It is not difficult to grasp the legitimacy that Leonardo could lend this enterprise. The paragone, the first section of the posthumously arranged notes that comprise the treatise of painting, argues compellingly for the superiority of painting to all the other arts, exhaustively preempting every conceivable objection. Leonardo's panegyric to the eye and to the optical sense is not lost on Dali either. But Dali's eccentric book mixes spoof with honest emulation in a way that distances Leonardo at the same time as it recalls him. 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship is couched in the form of advice to young painters, a rhetorical conceit Dali borrows from Leonardo. However, the secrets he divulges are often patently nonsensical. The artist, having become godlike in his mastery of drawing, is told that henceforth he should only draw in a state of complete nudity. He is instructed in the fabrication of assorted arcane and impractical devices, the aranarium and sea urchin telescope being two of those, and I illustrate the first of them on the right there. There is a strong sense in Dali that the second time can only be as irony or farce. Enter at this juncture in Dali's American career, Mattia Ghica, a Romanian expatriate and renowned devotee of the Golden Section. Ghica had the title of Prince, which doubtless would have commended him to Dali's attention when they met at a dinner party. It appears precisely at the moment that he was writing the 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship. In a letter dated 13th of August, 1947, Ghica writes to Dali that he is glad that he has received the French edition of his book and to be told that he had a part in the construction of the Leder Atomica. And I quote, "I await the tracing of the latter with the greatest interest," he adds. By means of his newfound acquaintance with Ghica, Dali learnt about a side of Leonardo, namely his mathematical interests, of which, without Ghica's tutelage, he would have been only dimly aware. Leonardo had long regarded optics and the study of perspective and proportion as foundations for a science of painting. With the arrival of Luca Pacioli in Milan in 1496, these mathematical pursuits were given new impetus. The illustrations that Leonardo created for Pacioli's De Divina Proportion, a treatise on geometry that he wrote in manuscript form in 1498, are regarded as an astonishing feat of draftsmanship. You can see a couple of the diagrams on the right-hand side there, which I've taken from one of Geeker's various volumes. With the aid of wooden models, Leonardo devised hollowed-out representations of a variety of regular polyhedrons, known as Platonic solids, that were shown in perspective, the open skeletal armature affording a startlingly direct apprehension of complex three-dimensional geometry. The illustrations accompanied an Italian translation of Piera della Francesca's text, Libellus de Quenci Corporibus, which comprised one of the sections of Pacioli's The Divine Proportion. Pacioli reputedly acted as a go-between, transmitting knowledge of perspective from Piero to Leonardo. Inspired by Pacioli, from 1497, Leonardo was motivated to undertake an independent study of Euclid's geometry. So absorbed did he become in the pursuit of mathematics for its own sake that a letter by a contemporary in 1501 reports that he cannot even bear to pick up a paintbrush. The preeminence of the exact sciences of geometry and mathematics in establishing the incorruptible foundations of painting is a message reiterated throughout the Treatise on Painting, from the famous proclamation in the opening section that, quote, no activity shall merit the name of science unless it rests upon mathematical proof, to the individual chapters dealing with linear perspective and proportion, the correct depiction of shadows and lighting, and other constituents of a science of painting. For a time, Geeker plays Pacioli to Dali's Leonardo, proffering advice to his eager pupil on matters of geometry and proportion. Dali possessed two books by Geeker in his personal library, one an American edition, The Geometry of Art and Life, and the other an earlier French language edition, Esthétique des Proportions dans la Nature et dans les Arts. It appears they were given to him by the author himself around the time of their meeting, and both are extensively annotated by Dali. The final chapter of the 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship, which Dali must have been in the throes of writing just when he met Geeker, contains a proficient, if not altogether serious, digest of Geeker. The Platonic solids, tetrahedron, cube, octahedron, dodecahedron, and icosahedron, these new playthings of Dali's imagination are strewn like toys in the margins of the book, their Latinate names flaunted like the mantras of an esoteric religion. Dali recommends to students that they have a joiner build portable geometric figures out of wooden strips, similar to the structures employed by Leonardo, but large enough so that live models could be posed inside them. Just to go back, there's the drawing at the top right there is a model for an icosahedral studio, artist's studio, and there's a sort of quainter, more endearing version of that in the 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship with Dali sort of hunched over in the pose that Astrid described earlier over his easel. Can we assume that Dali had first-hand knowledge of a treatise upon which he bestows such lavish praise, or was he simply names-dropping on the basis of rudiments picked up from Geeker? And I think these are references to Pacioli are extremely important in terms of augmenting the retro flavor of the 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship. His tongue-in-cheek advice to young American artists that they keep the book, namely Pacioli's, at their bedside is certainly preposterous, since there was and still is no English translation. The number and variety of figures that Dalí sprinkles throughout the pages of 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship exceeds those reproduced by Gieker, however. Further evidence that he had access to the original source is the adoption of a system of lettering expounded in a section of The Divine Proportion for his name as printed on the cover and title page of 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship, this very elaborate lettering. This ostentatious lettering first appears in 1941 on the cover of the catalogue for an exhibition at the Julian Levy Gallery, raising the possibility of an even earlier encounter with Pacioli. Somewhere, Dalí confesses that even he is unsure when he is being serious and when he is only joking. For the reader of 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship, this is a real dilemma. He who laughs last laughs best, affirms Dalí at one point, but there is no disguising that the intrusion of the comic into a genre that is about the transmission of the lofty principles of painting from one generation to the next betrays the no longer secure status of that activity and the broken continuity of the painterly tradition. I think I've got my slides slightly out of order, but not to worry. This next section is called Leonardo Complex. The secret life of Salvador Dalí, Dalí's gossipy autobiography, contains a very amusing account of his meeting with Sigmund Freud in July 1938. This was his big chance to impress the father of psychoanalysis. I quote, "I suddenly had the whim of trying to appear in his eyes as a kind of dandy of universal intellectualism," Dalí writes. With self-deprecating candor, Dalí admits that he learnt afterwards that the impression he, in fact, produced was the exact reverse. The remark betrays that Dalí had wanted to appear in Freud's eyes like Leonardo, who is, after all, the very exemplar of universal genius. As an assiduous reader of Freud from his student days, Dalí was, of course, thoroughly conversant with Freud's famous case study of Leonardo da Vinci, and cannot have overlooked in that text the signs of Freud's rampant idealization and over-identification with Leonardo's genius. On the right-hand side, I have a very rare photograph of Dalí and Freud on the occasion of that visit. It's a still from a play by Terry Johnson called wearing a very disagreeable jacket. Dalí's account of his visit was accompanied by an ink sketch of Freud in which his stated intention was to create a purely morphological drawing of the genius of psychoanalysis. Like the previously cited remark, the drawing unmistakably references Leonardo. The combination of multiple variant images on a single sheet, for example, is highly typical, a function of Leonardo's restless intellect, which meant he was never happy with just a single solution to any problem. The grimacing profile portrait, repeated three times at the left of the sheet, recalls Leonardo's pitiless caricatures of old age. Another telltale trait is the inclusion of notation on the sheet, in this case explaining rather ludicrously that the drawing represents the morphology of Freud's cranium according to the principle of a volute and a snail shell. By so overtly depicting Freud in the manner of Leonardo, Dalí alluded in 1942 to a complex set of psychic investments and a play of identifications in which he too was implicated, what I have elsewhere called Dalí's Leonardo complex. It was while Dalí was residing in the United States in the 1940s, far from home, that he began to conceive of a biblical pageant set against the backdrop of portly Ghat, in which he and Gala would both have their parts to play. We witness Gala's passage from bride to virgin, so to speak, the Madonna of portly Ghat, whose first appearance is as a frontispiece to the 50 Secrets. This image is the prelude to a later series of works by Dalí on the theme of the Assumption of the Virgin. Playing on his name Salvador, like Pujol's, Dalí depicts himself as the Christ child nestled on Gala's lap. This points to a further parallel with Leonardo, due to the fact that as an illegitimate child, he, so to speak, had a mother but no father. Freud contends that Leonardo identified himself with the Christ child and his mother with the Virgin Mary, a personal psychic investment that in later life is reflected in his artistic treatment of biblical subjects. Now I just need to go back momentarily. Divine Dalí, in direct proximity to Leonardo's drawings illustrating Pacioli's divine proportion, we have in the 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship what may be the first appearance of this sobriquet. Elsewhere, I've argued that Dalí's recreation as Divine Dalí was a function of his immersion in the 1930s and 40s in a Hollywood star system, and of his aspiration to perform stardom, if not to actually be a star. Stars, after all, are remote celestial beings, rather like divinities. And what I discovered when I was preparing a talk on this subject for an exhibition at Stockholm was that Greta Garbo, who was Swedish, was actually known as the Divine Garbo in this period. Simultaneously, however, it also points in another seemingly contrary direction, and this dual contradictory structure of reference is crucial. It genuflects to Leonardo da Vinci, who even in his own day was venerated as quasi-divine. Vasari liberally bestows the appellation divine upon Leonardo in his Lives of the Artists, and I quote, "The greatest gifts are often seen in the course of nature, reigned by celestial influences on human creatures, and sometimes in supernatural fashion, beauty, grace, and talent are united beyond measure in one single person, in a manner that to whatever such an one turns his attention, his every action is so divine that, surpassing all other men, it makes itself clearly known as a thing bestowed by God, as it is, and not acquired by human art. This was seen by all mankind in Leonardo da Vinci." Dalí brings into sharp relief the overlaps and disjunctures between an older notion of genius encapsulated by Leonardo and a contemporary notion of fame, presciently anticipating social commentators who have described this transformation. Daniel Boorstin, who links the transformation with the advent of mass culture, what he terms the graphic revolution, is adamant that we should not confuse heroism with celebrity. Whereas the designation of hero was hard-earned and generally had a relation to tangible achievements, the celebrity, by contrast, quote, is a person known for his well-knownness. Celebrity is a species of tautology. One is famed for being famous. It is a fabricated and factitious entity, a special case of what Boorstin calls the pseudo-event, by which he meant the dominance in media-based societies of images over reality, something that, in the guise of his paranoia criticism, also fascinated Dalí. In my account of Dalí, Leonardo da Vinci consorts promiscuously with Leonardo DiCaprio, fame and genius are not abandoned, but mutate into something more resembling celebrity. And as they do so, the primary locus of artistic production migrates from the artwork to the performance of an artistic persona. In The Secret Life, Dali confides the dawning awareness that he was playing at being a genius, an insight that he casts back to childhood, but that was probably of more recent acquisition. Dali's repeated boastful protestations of his own genius and his subversive contention that if you play a genius, you become one, offend against Vasari's conception of Leonardo's genius as divinely endowed, implying that when one can become a genius if one chooses to and pursue the task with enough zeal, books such as Diary of a Genius and The Unspeakable Confessions of Salvador Dali are couched like self-help manuals that strangely conform to the American dream of the self-made individual. And I quote, "Everyone throughout the world, and especially in America," Dali confides, "wants to know the secret formula for so much success." 50 Secrets establishes a direct connection with The Secret Life and is, in a sense, its continuation, with the spotlight shifted to Dali's life and daily routines as a painter. Karl Marx famously stated that all great world historic facts and personages appear twice, the first time as tragedy, the second time as farce. Dali's self-identification with Leonardo is marked by a shift of register from the heroic to the comic that reflects an awareness of his late coming. The story is well known that Dali had an older brother, also called Salvador, who had died whilst a young child. Dali saw himself as an exact replica of this deceased brother and claimed they were as alike as two drops of water. Believing that he had been brought into the world by his parents as a substitute for this lost original, of whom he retained an idealized image, and regarding himself as a second-hand copy of this more perfect avatar, Dali, I believe, imagines himself in a similar relation to Leonardo as a degraded, inauthentic replica. He was only too aware that his performance must inevitably fall short of the image, as phantasmal and unreal as that of his dead brother, conjured by Leonardo's name. Cosmic genius is transmuted into comic genius. The next section I've called The End of Painting. In the 1940s, Dali embarked on a retrograde course of promoting an anti-modern, illusionistic style of painting. Yet, at the same time that he is bent on restoring painting to the glory that it had in the Renaissance, Dali recognizes that painting is dead. With a delight in self-contradiction, but not without a touch of poignant regret, he proclaimed, and I quote, "Painting is dead, long live painting." The phrase adapts an expression uttered on the death of a ruler, "The king is dead, long live the king," whose conservative monarchical tenor doubtless contributed to its appeal. It takes the form of an epanalepsis, a rhetorical figure in which the two conjoined elements mirror one another. But it is also quite contradictory sounding, as though a corpse painting were being declared still alive. In an essay entitled The Death or Decline of Art from 1985, Gianni Vattimo, the Italian philosopher and political activist, analyzes the death of art under three aspects. Hegel's prediction of art's sublation by philosophy is realized, he says, albeit in caricatured form, in modernity. Vattimo speaks, first of all, of art's obsolescence at the hands of the mass media. Walter Benjamin described the withering away of the auratic properties of art in the age of technological reproduction. The aura, originally a function of the cultic value of the artwork within a fabric of tradition and ritual, came to be linked in the era of autonomous bourgeois art with the uniqueness of the original. Its corollary, seen from the artist's viewpoint, Vattimo asserts, is the idea of genius. The generalization of art as entertainment in the mass media is one of the forms of art's death. A second is the avant-garde ambition to abolish art by reintegrating it into life. And a third is the path of high modernism, which sets an ever more restricted program for art as a last-ditch attempt to resist the encroachments of mass culture. Dali was well acquainted with each of these fates. Vattimo states that the actual event of art's death, which ought to coincide with a cessation of art production, is indefinitely postponed. Thus, it is more accurate to speak of the decline of art. This paradoxical situation in which art continues to be produced, all the while contemplating its own death, quote, constitutes the historical and ontological constellation in which we move. Yves Alain Bois argues that the task of mourning that one might more readily associate with postmodern art also fell to modernism earlier in the 20th century. The end of modern art was foretold in its birth. The origins of abstraction, Bois notes, can be located in the liberation from mimesis brought about by the invention of photography, with which it is historically coterminous. At the same time, the crisis of art in industrial modernity, due to the appearance of photography and mass reproduction, was understood as signaling the end of art. In a comment that bears upon Dali's emulation of Ernst Meissonier's technique, Bois observes that traditional painterly finish and the mechanical come together and are fused in the slick surface of 19th century academic painting, to which modernist art of the kind Dali intensely disliked arose in opposition. Here, there is not space to examine the myriad ways in which Dali's painting is infiltrated by photographic technologies and the associated modes of perception, but like de Chirico's practice of copying, which only gathers pace in the 1920s, it registers the very conditions that his reversion to a traditional painterly craft supposedly is reacting against. Painting is invaded by the technology that spelt its end. 50 Secrets contains a frank admission of Dali's dependence on photography. And I quote, "When you know how to draw, but only then, the use of snapshots in certain cases may be valuable to you. You must realize that a camera is rigid and mechanical, and your eye, on the contrary, is soft and full of an inventive whimsicality which the poor lens in no wise possesses." Interestingly, Clement Greenberg seems to have discerned this trait. Greenberg annexes the whole of surrealist art to his definition of kitsch, though plainly he has in mind Dali when he writes that, and I quote, "For the sake of hallucinatory vividness, the surrealists have copied the effects of the calendar reproduction, postal card chromotype, and magazine illustration. They prize the qualities of the popular reproduction because of its incongruously prosaic associations, and because the reproduction heightens illusionistic effect by erasing paint texture and brushstroke." Symptomatic of the precarious condition of painting, Dali repeatedly portrays painting itself as needing to be propped up perilously from within the picture frame by one of his famous crutches in one instance and by the lid of a grand piano in another. Partial Hallucinations, Six Apparitions of Lenin on a Piano of 1931, is like a textbook exercise in post-Renaissance single-point perspective. Note that the raised lid of the piano precisely touches the back edge of the ceiling in a simple box-shaped room. The edge runs strictly parallel to the upper border of the painting, for which it serves as a proxy within the image. Thus, the piano lid, like the open door at the back of the room, opens up a pictorial space that it supports, as it in turn is supported. In Sleep, the picture on the right-hand side, a self-portrait head is held aloft by crutches, as if to infer that the whole edifice of the dream world is liable to come crashing down at any instant. But one of the crutches has also been called upon to preserve the upper edge of the picture from itself toppling down like a broken window shutter. Painting limps along, leaning on a prosthetic support. Dali's crusade to restore painting to its past glory was conducted under the aegis of Leonardo da Vinci. Leda Atomica, one of the pictures Dali showcases in 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship, poignantly stages painting as a lost origin through its relation to one of Leonardo's most famous works. Leonardo's painting of Leda and the Swan, a subject that occupied him for almost a decade, is known now only from pen and ink studies for the painting and from several variant copies, of which the Wilton House version attributed to Cesare de Sesto is believed to be the most accurate, and that's one that I've reproduced there. Leonardo took the completed picture with him to France in 1516, where it was housed in François I's appartement des bains at Fontainebleau in conditions that caused the panel to deteriorate, and it was lost in the course of the next century. By coincidence, Dali was forced to abandon the first version of Leda Atomica after the wood panel on which it was painted was subject to extensive fine cracking of the surface, in effect suffering the fate of the lost Leonardo original. He repainted the work on canvas, which was described as still unfinished when it was reproduced in the 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship. The idea of a repetition without an origin that we saw in Dali's reference to his elder brother, and that we find once again here, inevitably tinges the repeated instance with connotations of lack and belatedness, as well as inauthenticity. In a remark that underscores the unavoidable centrality of Marcel Duchamp to the rhetoric of the end of art, Yves Alain-Bois writes, and I quote, "Mass production seemed to bode the end of painting through its most elaborate mise-en-scène, the invention of the ready-made. Ironically, the rebirth that Dali sought was put in jeopardy by the very start by Duchamp's Dadaist defacement of a postcard reproduction of the Mona Lisa, a trifling gesture that nonetheless spelt the doom of painting as a time-honored activity whose cultural value had persisted unquestioned until the early years of the 20th century, with Leonardo da Vinci as one of its highest pinnacles." Of his belatedness in relation to that history of art, Dali was acutely aware, and I quote, "Elle a chaud au cœur" can be taken quite adequately as the epitaph of modern painting, he wrote in 1959. Philip Halsman's photograph of Dali impersonating the Mona Lisa is a witty retake of Duchamp, his own moustache taking the place of the drawn one, but it unwittingly reveals the omnipresence of a gesture of cancellation that stalks Dali's every move. Portraying the chaste Mona Lisa, festooned with coins, plying her wares for money, Dali cocks a snoot at Breton, who branded him Avis de Dollars, an anagram formed from the letters of his name, but he also thematizes paintings Fall from Grace. This is made more plaintive by repeated assertions of the nobility of painting in the 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship that echo Leonardo's urgings to young painters to forsake material wealth for the ever greater riches and fame that only the pursuit of art can bring. Emphasizing once more its symmetry with the secret life, the 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship ends with an admission of Dali's lack of religious faith, as the earlier book had done. In a book about painting, dedicated to youth who have faith in true painting, this confession registers a more far-reaching doubt that besets the profession to which Dali devoted his life. From the vantage point of current debates about obsolescence, among the questions that Dali causes us to ponder is whether there are radical and reactionary forms of anachronism, and if so, how to differentiate them, and moreover, whether a practice of painting that acknowledges the end of painting and is aware of its conspicuous anachronism can nonetheless harbor a critical or radical potential. Thank you.
Bé, obrirem ara un torn de paraules, una mica de debat, abans de fer el break. Si algú vol preguntar alguna cosa.
Would you accept that this saying, the end of painting, coincides in time with some other people saying the end of music, the end of philosophy, etc.? Would you accept this?
Of course, yes, absolutely.
What meaning do you give to that more general cry?
Well, you know, there was very much a sort of vogue for this in the 80s, you know, at the time of, you know, around the time of Vattimo's essay. I'd looked into this, but there are a number of books that were published around that point of the mid 1980s. I remember very
even before that.
Yes. But you know, just to stick with the, you know, this moment of the mid 1980s, which coincides, of course, with the emergence of postmodern, you know, sort of appropriation art and, you know, similar kinds of practices. You know, one of the volumes that sticks in my mind, because I, you know, started studying art history, you know, around that point, well, in the late 1980s at the Courtauld, and at that very time, Hans Belting published a book titled The End of Art History. So I thought, okay, you know, I'm just sort of setting out. But there, you know, there were a whole bunch of books, as you say, and, you know, the you know, Francis Fukuyama's, you know, sort of famous proclamation of the sort of neo-Hegelian, you know, sort of proclamation of the end of history is around that point. And I guess that's the kind of discourse that's, you know, sort of framing my reading of Dali here. You know, there were, you know, I think there are indications of Dali's awareness of his sort of late coming, as I say, in relation to that tradition. And while, you know, in the statement that we've got here, he attempts to displace this death onto the modern art, sort of the art that he sought to differentiate himself from. I think the kind of anti-art gestures of Duchamp and this extremely sort of virulent anti-art impulse that sort of resurfaces in Surrealism around 1930 at the precise point where Dali joins the movement, that Dali was not sort of impervious to that, and that his work as a painter, and I've sort of argued similarly of Juan Miró, is coloured by this avant-garde gesture of putting an end to painting. I think that painting for an artist such as Dalí was never something straightforward. And of course, as I argued also, I think that while he is first and foremost a painter, that the locus of artistic of creative production, if you like, gets shifted into a sort of range of other activities, and particularly into this performance of a persona, Dalí. Did that answer your question, or not precisely?
To some extent, yeah. I do think that when people argue and say, well, that's the end of music, the end of philosophy, the end of history, and the end of art, the end of painting, what they mean, in fact, is that stop that way of doing history, music, philosophy,
yes.
Or art. And here should start something new. Whether that's true or not, that's a different matter. But they claim we should put an end to the old-fashioned way of working on that field. I think that's the main...
Okay, yes, that's a kind of revolutionary project, isn't it? A kind of avant-gardist project, if you like, to put a stop to to eradicate the old and to put something totally new in its place. But what I think
you expose the phrase, and the second part of the of the phrase is long live the king.
Yeah.
So that it means I'm not sure. Well, I don't mind that no king should be there. The old king, the old way of being a king, the old way of acting, that's dead. That's, we should finish with that. I think that's, sorry that I interrupted you, but I think that's the main thing they are proclaiming.
I would agree, absolutely that is the a description of a revolutionary or sort of avant-garde stance sort of vis-a-vis the aesthetic, but Dali's notion or sort of embrace of anachronism is a different strategy entirely. It's a rehabilitation something which is considered obsolete, and it's sort of conspicuous by that fact. I think the question is whether that is a radical or a reactionary strategy, and I think Dali makes it very difficult for us to decide. And what I was sort of trying to show in my paper is how easily anachronism shifts from one to the other.
Sì, ai primero.
I read a book that was published in 1966. It was a foreword by, and forgive me, I've forgotten the gentleman's name, he was the then curator of paintings at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And it was a book about Dalí. And in the foreword, he defines modern art as being the definition of modern art, the modern artist is based on the abstract idea and the avant-garde idea, but of the modern artists then present in the world, that Dalí was the only one who really had the ability to paint like a classicist. I'm wondering if Dalí suffered a kind of schizophrenic identity crisis in the sense that he had the very strong urge to think in terms of modernity and be an avant-garde, but his biological urge as an artist, his evolutionary gift, so to speak, that was nurtured under the classicist system, was something he was not prepared to let go. And that his art is a strange combination of this need to be in the forefront of ideas, which he expressed in so many other art forms, such as writing and performance and sculpture, but to not let go of this sort of beautifully cultivated and divine gift that he had since birth. And if we can view him as some sort of transitional artist in that regard.
I think that's very well put, actually. I felt a sense of trepidation, really, sort of presenting on Dalí in this sort of august conference. The expectation is that you sort of know something about Dalí and know how all the pieces, fit together. And I'm not sure that I do, but I think if I've intuited anything, it's along the lines that you suggest, that Dalí's predicament was quite a poignant one, that he's, this book shows that he is genuinely passionate about painting, and yet he's, he's part of an avant-garde that wanted to, be done with all of that. I see that as a sort of fundamental problematic that sort of explains a lot to me about Dalí. Yeah.
I have read Matilda Dica's memories a long time ago, but I am not completely sure that Dalí didn't knew the books by Dica before. I think in the library here there are two copies of the Esthétique et Proportion de la Nature.
Yes.
So this for me could be explained perhaps he has read and worked about this before meeting Dica.
Yes.
Before the Dica's book, as you know, were very popular in the intellectual circles in Paris, in the circles. At this time, one of the books is a preface by Valéry, and I have found this book in many libraries of painters of this time. I have myself the copy of Maruja Mayo, who was a friend of Dalí at the Royal Academy of Arts in the 20s. So I think the meeting with in California with Dica, I think, is a reconfirmation of something probably he had before, no, this knowledge. And the other thing, Dica, of course, is very fundamental for him, but he had also in his library a Spanish translation of the Lucas.
Yes, absolutely.
Remember. It's a copy, I don't remember the translator, but I remember it's a big book. The aspect is very similar to the treatise by Dalí. It's published in Buenos Aires by Losada, which is a very big company, and the preface is by a poet who is also somebody of the Dalí generation, who is Alberti, the closest friend of Lorca. No? So this was on two places.
Well, I have looked at that copy of the Pacioli treatise, which is, sort of, together with Leonardo's treatise is, I think they're the two, perhaps the two most sort of important intertexts, as it were, for Dalí's own treatise. And that was published in 1947 from recollection, so had Dali, you know, acquired it, you know, it would have been, well, it, you know, it was hot off the press when Dali wrote The 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship. But, you know, the intriguing fact is that Dali uses Pacioli's system of lettering around, I think it's around 1940 for an exhibition catalogue at the Julian Levy Gallery. And I think that's something that he could only have been aware of from consulting directly Pacioli's book on divine proportion, because that's not a section of the book that's of any interest to Gieke, who's you know, sort of focuses exclusively on the Platonic solids. So you know, I think that's interesting and sort of slightly mysterious to me, the, you know, point at which Dali encountered Pacioli. I wouldn't be at all surprised, as you say, that Dali had come across Gieke's writings well before that, because it's really of a piece with his morphological interests in Wentworth, in Darcy Wentworth Thompson's Growth and Form, which is also cited quite extensively in the 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship. And these were being these volumes were being read widely, and including by the very abstract artists Dali claims to. Yes, yes.
Sometimes the answer is in the same question. Dali used to say, well, you have technique, but you have no imagination, so you're just folklore. When you have imagination, but you have no technique, you cannot communication. Nobody understands you. When you have technique and imagination, then it's very good, but you need genders.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. The you know, this question of technique, it it, you know, it relates to the, you know, the word techne, meaning art. In you know, there is no distinction between sort of technology and art in the Greek sense. Please correct me if I'm talking rubbish. I'm you know, this is something that De Chirico makes great play with in his treatise on the techniques of painting from the late 1920s. And I think there are lots of parallels between Dali and De Chirico in this regard. I think around this, in this sort of interwar period, people are searching around for different ways to define painting and, you know, to the project of painting. I think Heidegger's essay on the work of art in the mid-1930s presents interesting parallels with the situation. Well, it's not so much Dali as Miro, as that I've looked at this in relation to. There's a similar kind of quest for, or problematization of, the foundations of painting. So in you know, one sort of response to that is to, you know, go back to the origins, or what you imagine as the origins of painting. And, you know, certainly that's a kind of, you know, Dali's Leda Atomica, which has this kind of manifesto status, is it's a picture that has a, you know, sort of phantasmatic relation to a certain kind of origin of painting.